Bailout Outrage. The public furor over the financial crisis of 2008-2009 is a case in point. For years, stock prices and real estate values had climbed. The reckoning came when the housing bubble burst. Wall Street banks and financial institutions had made billions of dollars on complex instruments backed by mortgages whose value now plunged. In October 2008, President George W. Bush asked Congress for $700 billion to bail out the nation's big banks and financial firms. It didn't seem fair that Wall Street had enjoyed huge profits during the good times and was now asking taxpayers to foot the bill when things had gone bad. But there seemed no alternative. The banks and financial firms had grown so fast and so entwined with every aspect of the economy that their collapse might bring down the entire financial system. They were, it was said, too big to fail. No one claimed that the banks and investment houses deserved the money. Their reckless bets, enabled by inadequate government regulation, had created the crisis. But here was a case where the welfare of the economy as a whole seemed to outweigh considerations of fairness. Congress reluctantly appropriated the bailout funds. Then came the bonuses. Shortly after the bailout money began to flow, news accounts revealed that some of the companies, now on the public dole, were awarding millions of dollars in bonuses to their executives. The most egregious case involved the American International Group, AIG, an insurance giant brought to ruin by the risky investments of its financial products unit. Despite having been rescued with massive infusions of government funds, totaling $173 billion, the company paid $165 million in bonuses to executives in the very division that had precipitated the crisis. 73 employees received bonuses of $1 million or more. News of the bonuses set off a firestorm of public protest. Something was wrong with this picture. Although the U.S. government now owned 80% of the company, the Treasury Secretary pleaded in vain with AIG's government-appointed CEO to rescind the bonuses. "We cannot attract and retain the best and the brightest talent," the CEO replied, "if employees believe their compensation is subject to continued and arbitrary adjustment by the U.S. Treasury." He claimed the employees' talents were needed to unload the toxic assets for the benefit of the taxpayers, who, after all, owned most of the company. The public reacted with fury. A full-page headline in the tabloid New York Post captured the sentiments of many. "Not so fast, you greedy bastards," it said. The U.S. House of Representatives sought to claw back the payments by approving a bill that would impose a 90% tax on bonuses paid to employees of companies that received substantial bailout funds. Under pressure from New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, 15 of the top 20 AIG bonus recipients agreed to return the payments, and some $50 million was recouped in all. This gesture assuaged public anger to some degree, and support for the punitive tax measure faded in the Senate. But the episode left the public reluctant to spend more to clean up the mess the financial industry had created. Underlying the bailout outrage was a belief about moral desert. The executives receiving the bonuses and the companies receiving the bailouts didn't deserve them. But why didn't they? The reason may be less obvious than it seems. Consider two possible answers. One is about greed, the other about failure. One source of outrage was that the bonuses seemed to reward greed, as the tabloid headline indelicately suggested. The public found this morally unpalatable. Not only the bonuses, but the bailout as a whole seemed perversely to reward greedy behavior rather than punish it. the derivatives traders had landed their company and the country in dire financial peril by making reckless investments in pursuit of ever greater profits. Having pocketed the profits when times were good, they saw nothing wrong with million-dollar bonuses even after their investments had come to ruin. The problem with the greed critique is that it doesn't distinguish the rewards bestowed by the bailout after the crash from the rewards bestowed by markets when times were flush. Greed is a vice, a bad attitude, an excessive, single-minded desire for gain. So it's understandable that people aren't keen to reward it. But is there any reason to assume that the recipients of bailout bonuses are any greedier now than they were a few years ago, or when they were riding high and reaping even greater rewards? Wall Street traders, bankers, and hedge fund managers are a hard-charging lot. The pursuit of financial gain is what they do for a living. Whether or not their vocation taints their character, their virtue is unlikely to rise or fall with the stock market. So if it's wrong to reward greed with big bailout bonuses, isn't it also wrong to reward it with market largesse? The public was outraged when in 2008, Wall Street firms, some on taxpayer-subsidized life support, handed out $16 billion in bonuses. But this figure was less than half the amounts paid out in 2006, $34 billion, and 2007, $33 billion. If greed is the reason they don't deserve the money now, on what basis can it be said that they deserved the money then? One obvious difference is that bailout bonuses come from the taxpayer, while the bonuses paid in good times come from company earnings. If the outrage is based on the conviction that the bonuses are undeserved, however, the source of the payment is not morally decisive. But it does provide a clue. The reason the bonuses are coming from the taxpayer is that the companies have failed. This takes us to the heart of the complaint. The American public's real objection to the bonuses and the bailout is not that they reward greed, but that they reward failure. Americans are harder on failure than on greed. In market-driven societies, ambitious people are expected to pursue their interests vigorously, and the line between self-interest and greed often blurs. But the line between success and failure is etched more sharply. And the idea that people deserve the rewards that success bestows is central to the American dream. One of the most bizarre statements about bailout ethics came from Senator Charles Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, a fiscal conservative from the heartland. At the height of the bonus furor, Grassley said in an Iowa radio interview that what bothered him most was the refusal of the corporate executives to take any blame for their failures. He would feel, he said, a bit better toward them if they would follow the Japanese example and come before the American people and take that deep bow and say, "I'm sorry," and then either do one of two things, resign or go commit suicide. Grassley later explained that he was not calling on the executives to commit suicide, but he did want them to accept responsibility for their failure, to show contrition, and to offer a public apology. "I haven't heard this from CEOs," he said, "and it just makes it very difficult for the taxpayers of my district to just keep shoveling money out the door." Grassley's comments support my hunch that the bailout anger was not mainly about greed. What most offended Americans' sense of justice was that their tax dollars were being used to reward failure. If that's right, it remains to ask whether this view of the bailouts was justified. Were the CEOs and top executives of the big banks and investment firms really to blame for the financial crisis? Many of the executives didn't think so. Testifying before congressional committees investigating the financial crisis, they insisted they had done all they could with the information available to them. The former chief executive of Bear Stearns, a Wall Street investment firm that collapsed in 2008, said he'd pondered long and hard whether he could have done anything differently. He concluded he'd done all he could. Quote, "I just simply have not been able to come up with anything that would have made a difference to the situation we faced." The tsunami metaphor became part of bailout vernacular, especially in financial circles. If the executives are right that the failure of their companies was due to larger economic forces, not their own decisions, this would explain why they didn't express the remorse that Senator Grassley wanted to hear. But it also raises a far-reaching question about failure, success, and justice. If big systemic economic forces account for the disastrous losses of 2008 and 2009, couldn't it be argued that they also account for the dazzling gains of earlier years? If the weather is to blame for the bad years, how can it be that the talent, wisdom, and hard work of bankers, traders, and Wall Street executives are responsible for the stupendous returns that occurred when the sun was shining? Confronted with public outrage over paying bonuses for failure, the CEOs argued that financial returns are not wholly their own doing, but the product of forces beyond their control. They may have a point, but if this is true, there's good reason to question their claim to outsized compensation when times are good. In 2007, CEOs at major U.S. corporations were paid 344 times the pay of the average worker. On what grounds, if any, do executives deserve to make that much more than their employees? Most of them work hard and bring talent to their work. But consider this. In 1980, CEOs earned only 42 times what their workers did. Were executives less talented and hardworking in 1980 than they are today? Or do pay differentials reflect contingencies unrelated to talents and skills? Or compare the level of executive compensation in the United States with that in other countries. CEOs at top U.S. companies earn an average of $13.3 million per year compared to $6.6 million for European chief executives and $1.5 million for CEOs in Japan. Are American executives twice as deserving as their European counterparts and nine times as deserving as Japanese CEOs? Or do these differences reflect factors unrelated to the effort and talent that executives bring to their jobs? The bailout outrage that gripped the United States in early 2009 expressed the widely held view that people who wreck the companies they run with risky investments don't deserve to be rewarded with millions of dollars in bonuses. But the argument over the bonuses raises questions about who deserves what when times are good. Do the successful deserve the bounty that markets bestow upon them? Or does that bounty depend on factors beyond their control? And what are the implications for the mutual obligations of citizens in good times and hard times? Whether the financial crisis will prompt public debate on these broader questions remains to be seen. Three approaches to justice. To ask whether a society is just is to ask how it distributes the things we prize. Income and wealth, duties and rights, powers and opportunities, offices and honors. A just society distributes these goods in the right way. It gives each person his or her due. The hard questions begin when we ask what people are due and why. We've already begun to wrestle with these questions. As we've pondered the rights and wrongs of price gouging, competing claims to the Purple Heart, and financial bailouts, we've identified three ways of approaching the distribution of goods: welfare, freedom, and virtue. Each of these ideals suggests a different way of thinking about justice. Some of our debates reflect disagreement about what it means to maximize welfare, or respect freedom, or cultivate virtue. Others involve disagreement about what to do when these ideals conflict. Political philosophy cannot resolve these disagreements once and for all, but it can give shape to the arguments we have and bring moral clarity to the alternatives we confront as democratic citizens. Before attempting to assess these theories of justice, it's worth asking how philosophical arguments can proceed, especially in so contested a domain as moral and political philosophy. They often begin with concrete situations. As we've seen in our discussion of price gouging, Purple Hearts, and bailouts, moral and political reflection finds its occasion in disagreement. Often, the disagreements are among partisans or rival advocates in the public realm. Sometimes, the disagreements are within us as individuals, as when we find ourselves torn or conflicted about a hard moral question. But how exactly can we reason our way from the judgments we make about concrete situations to the principles of justice we believe should apply in all situations? What, in short, does moral reasoning consist in? To see how moral reasoning can proceed, let's turn to two situations, one a fanciful hypothetical story much discussed by philosophers, the other an actual story about an excruciating moral dilemma. Consider first this philosopher's hypothetical. Like all such tales, it involves a scenario stripped of many realistic complexities so that we can focus on a limited number of philosophical issues. The runaway trolley. Suppose you are the driver of a trolley car hurtling down the track at 60 miles an hour. Up ahead, you see five workers standing on the track, tools in hand. You try to stop, but you can't. The brakes don't work. You feel desperate because you know that if you crash into these five workers, they will all die. Let's assume you know that for sure.